From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
My fight is to get out of prison. Not to be bitter. Not to seek vengeance on anyone. Not to hate anyone. But to get out of prison.
Those are the words of Gary Tyler. He's been in jail for more than three decades for a crime many believe he did not commit. The Pardon Board has ruled in his favor three times. We'll broadcast for the first time an interview with Gary Tyler in jail. We'll talk with his mother and sister in New Orleans. They've just come back from visiting him at Angola Prison in Louisiana. And we'll speak with award-winning New York Times columnist Bob Herbert.
So this is an injustice that has lasted just for the better part of this person's life. It's a real tragedy.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Bush administration has dismissed suggestions its presence at an international conference on Iraq could lead to direct talks with Iran and Syria. Hopes were raised after Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice confirmed the U.S. would join a regional meeting called by the Iraqi government. But on Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Tony Snow said the administration has not dropped its precondition that Iran abandon nuclear activities. Iran says it's weighing the Iraqi invitation. Meanwhile, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad made some of his first public comments since the announcement of the upcoming talks on Iraq.
The arrival of foreign forces and the intervention of the hegemonic system in the affairs of the people of this country is the root cause of the problems in Iraq.
Ahmadinejad spoke as he began a two-day visit to Sudan. He's expected to sign a series of economic agreements to boost ties between Tehran and Khartoum. Meanwhile, a review of American casualties in Iraq has further undercut the Bush administration's claim that Iran is supplying bombs to Shiite insurgents that have targeted U.S. troops. McClatchy Newspapers is reporting 90% of U.S. casualties have come in Sunni areas. Some of those deaths were caused by explosively formed projectiles, or EFPs. The administration had suggested the EFPs were being used almost exclusively by Iranian-backed Shiite groups. As the Bush administration dismisses the significance of the upcoming talks alongside Iran, the State Department has announced a meeting next week with North Korea. The talks will focus on normalizing relations with North Korea under the initial nuclear deal reached last month. State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick warned against expecting a major breakthrough.
I think a big part of the meeting is just going to be organizational issues. How is this working group going to meet? What are the modalities of it? Don't expect anybody to come out the front door on March 6th waving a piece of paper with breakthrough agreements. That's just not the kind of meeting that this is going to be.
The talks come as the Bush administration is now softening its position that North Korea has pursued a nuclear weapon through the enrichment of uranium. The charge was first made nearly 5 years ago. North Korea followed by throwing out international inspectors and increasing the plutonium stockpile behind its first nuclear test last year. Critics say the administration's revised stance raises new questions about the initial decision to confront North Korea and about intelligence on foreign weapons programs in general. The Guardian of London is reporting top U.S. military advisors are warning they have only 6 months to win the war before a further collapse of political and public support here in the United States. The advisors are said to be in charge of carrying out President Bush's troop increase announced earlier this year. In the occupied territories, the Israeli military siege on Nablus is in its fifth day. Earlier today, Israeli forces traded gunfire with Palestinian militants in a mosque in the Farah refugee camp. Dozens of people have been arrested while the Nablus television station has been shut down. Meanwhile, in Jenin, hundreds of Palestinians gathered Wednesday for the funeral of three Palestinians killed earlier in the day. Israel says two of the dead were responsible for a failed suicide bombing attempt in Tel Aviv last week. Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh said Israel is trying to disrupt the Palestinian Unity Agreement.
It has become clear that this Israeli escalation, whether through repeated incursions on Nablus or the assassination of Palestinian leaders of the resistance, is directly tied with the Israeli refusal of the Mecca Agreement, which cemented the national unity government on the basis of Palestinian consensus.
Back in the United States, a federal judge has ruled Jose Padilla is competent to stand trial of charges of aiding al-Qaeda. Padilla's attorneys had asked the court to order treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. A forensic psychologist had also testified Padilla may be suffering from Stockholm syndrome, in which captives identify with their captors. The Bush administration jailed Padilla without charge after initially accusing him of plotting a dirty bomb attack. Padilla was held in extreme isolation without almost any human contact for about 1,300 days and denied an attorney for nearly 2 years. A trial is set to begin in 2 weeks. New developments in the Walter Reed hospital scandal. The Army Times is reporting soldiers stationed at the U.S. Army's top medical facility have been told they're no longer allowed to speak to the media. One soldier in the medical hold unit said many troops believe the media ban is a form of punishment for the whistleblowing that led to last month's disclosure the Walter Reed Hospital is in major decay. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports today top officials at Walter Reed have heard patient complaints about poor treatment for more than 3 years. The officials include Lieutenant General Kevin C. Kiley, the former head of Walter Reed, and the current Army Surgeon General. The Senate Armed Services Committee is set to hold hearings on the conditions at Walter Reed next week. On Capitol Hill, Democratic leaders have announced plans to seek testimony from several prosecutors who lost their jobs in a wave of dismissals from the Bush administration. The attorney firings and their replacements have raised allegations of judicial interference. The House will vote today on whether to subpoena four former prosecutors. The move comes as the outgoing U.S. attorney in New Mexico has spoken out on his firing. In an interview with McClatchy Newspapers, David Iglesias linked his forced departure to his refusal to aggressively purse the indictment of local Democrats before congressional elections last year. Iglesias says two lawmakers asked him to push the indictments in what he believes was an effort to create a campaign issue. He said, quote, "I believe that because I didn't play ball, so to speak, I was asked to resign." Iglesias did not give names, but the Washington Post reports it received denials from all New Mexico lawmakers except Republican Senator Pete Domenici and Republican Congressmember Heather Wilson. On the campaign trail, John McCain has confirmed he will seek the Republican presidential nomination in 2008. McCain made his announcement Wednesday on The Late Show with David Letterman.
Are you thinking seriously of running? Are you running? Or are you going to announce that you're running?
The last time we were on this program, I'm sure you remember everything very clearly.
Yes.
That we say, but you asked me if I would come back on the show.
Right.
If I was going to announce.
Yes.
I am announcing that I will be a candidate for President of the United States.
Oh, wow.
Senator McCain says he will formally enter the race after he visits Iraq next month. A new census has estimated the nation's homeless population at 750,000 people. The Department of Housing and Urban Development says that's about 300,000 more than the number of available beds in shelters and temporary housing. Around 60% of the homeless population are people of color. Here in New York, the city council has approved a ban on the use of the N-word. The symbolic vote was passed unanimously. The first U.S. Marine to suffer a critical injury in Iraq is speaking out against the ban on openly gay and lesbians in the military. The Marine, Staff Sergeant Eric Alva, lost his right leg after stepping on a landmine. Alva, who is gay, says his injury led him to come out so he could seek the same rights for all service members, regardless of sexual orientation. And finally, Arthur Schlesinger has died at the age of 89. Schlesinger was a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, key figure in the Kennedy White House. He was an early supporter of the Vietnam War, but in his later years, an opponent of the invasion of Iraq. In his memoirs, Schlesinger expressed regret for helping suppress a New Republic story that showed the Kennedy administration was training Cuban mercenaries before the Bay of Pigs invasion. in a 2004 interview on Lenny Lopate show on the radio station WNYC in New York, Sussinger talked about the Iraq War in historical context.
The First World War and the Second World War were collaborative wars, and that's why we won them. And the fact that only Britain has made a serious military contribution to the unilateralist action of the United States has been one source of trouble. I think no one can defend the evident mess. The evidence is like the quagmire reenacted.
Arthur Schlesinger, dead at the age of 89. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Amnesty International has renewed its call for Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco to pardon Gary Tyler, who is serving a life sentence without parole in the Angola prison. He's been in jail since he was 16 years old for a crime that many believe he did not commit. The pardon board has ruled in his favor three times. On October 7, 1974, a white mob enraged over school integration attacked a school bus filled with black students in Destrehan, Louisiana. In the frenzy, a 13-year-old white student named Timothy Weber was shot dead. Gary Tyler was one of the black students aboard that bus. He was arrested and then tried by an all-white jury. The case against him rested on the statements of four witnesses, all of whom have since recanted. Within a year, he was convicted and sentenced to death in the electric chair. He became the youngest person on death row in the country. Tyler escaped electrocution only because the Supreme Court declared Louisiana's death penalty unconstitutional.
For the past 32 years, Gary Tyler has always maintained his innocence. In 1981, a federal appeals court ruled Tyler was, quote, denied a fundamentally fair trial. Even Louisiana's own Board of Pardons has issued rulings on three occasions that would have allowed Tyler to be freed. But Tyler remains behind bars. His case has been called one of the great miscarriages of justice in the modern history of the United States.
Bob Herbert of the New York Times and a former colleague of mine at the Daily News recently wrote a series of columns on Gary Tyler that has sparked renewed interest in the 32-year-old case. Bob Herbert joins us in our Firehouse studio now.
Juan, Amy, how are you?
It's great to be with you.
Welcome, Bob. And could you lay out for us some of the key aspects of this case?
Well, I think the first important thing to keep in mind is that the black kids on the school bus were the victims as this story began to unfold. The bus was being attacked by an enraged mob of whites who were upset over school integration. When the shot rang out, the kids on the bus dove for the floor to take cover. They assumed somebody was shooting at them. The bus driver, who's a neutral person in this issue, has always maintained that someone outside the bus fired the weapon. But when this young white boy fell over, Timothy Weber, 13 years old, mortally wounded, the rage just got out of control. And the assumption in the mob, and I guess among law enforcement too, was that it had to have been a black person who fired the shot. Interestingly enough, Gary Tyler wasn't a suspect at first. He's taken off the bus, and all the kids are searched. All the kids on the bus were searched. The bus was searched. None of the people in the crowd were searched. But the sheriff's deputies were talking to Gary Tyler's cousin, who was also on the bus, and asked him about something that was hanging from his neck. And Gary Tyler said to one of the deputies, well, that has nothing to do with anything. He made a smart remark to the deputy. I believe that that's what led the deputies to target him. The word came back that Timothy Weber had died, and the crowd went out of control. Deputies took Gary Tyler in, and they beat him, and I believe this to be true because there's a lot of witnesses to this. They beat him unmercifully, trying to get him to confess, but he never confessed. You mentioned that in a little over a year, this whole process unfolded. That is remarkably fast. This kid was arrested, indicted, tried before an all-white jury and sentenced to electrocution, and it only took just a shade over a year.
In a few minutes, we're going to play a never-before-played excerpt of an interview with Gary Tyler. But we are also joined by Gary Tyler's mother, Juanita Tyler, and his sister, Bobby McCray, in New Orleans at public television station WLAE. They just visited Gary at the Angola prison yesterday. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! And let me first turn to Juanita Tyler, Gary's mother. How is your son?
Oh, he's very happy, you know. He's doing good.
Bob Herbert was just telling us about those days when your son was arrested, when he was taken off the bus, when he was beaten. Can you tell us your experience of this in your own words? Where were you when Gary was first arrested?
At work. I was at work.
And how did you hear?
When I came home, I was stopped in the block of a lady saying that the kids said they had said, I think that's your boys in the police car. So I went to the substation, and that was my son, Garrett.
And during the period of the trial, could you talk to us about the climate at the time and how your son was treated during the trial period?
See, we wasn't allowed in the trial. We wasn't allowed nowhere in the courtroom or nothing. My whole family, nobody was relative to Gary, could not go into the trial. So I can't say what really happened in there because we wasn't allowed in the court.
And why were you not allowed in the court?
They said that I was going to be a witness, but I never was called a witness.
Bob Herbert, you have a question for Juanita, for Gary's mother.
Mrs. Tyler, when they first arrested Gary and took him to the sheriff's station, you were there when they actually beat him. Is that correct? And could you tell us about that?
Yes. See, they was already at the substation when I got there. And Gary was sitting in the police car. So they took Gary when the police came off the bus with a whole seat saying that they had a gun. They goes inside and they came back out to the police car and got Gary out of the police car and brought him in the substation. That's what they call it at the time, the substation. And they brought him in. So I goes in to try to question or get somebody to tell me something that I was asked to leave, leave from up there, because everybody leave then. So I end up and I went back to try to, just call my husband to tell him what had happened and try to get some kind of help, but we ain't know what to do. So I goes back up to the substation. That's when I was able to hear two officers were sitting in the front part of the desk, and I asked them if I could talk to my son. I could hear something. I could hear the groan and beating. And I tried, but they, so many police and stuff around, I wasn't allowed to. Nothing.
And Bobby McCray, all these years now, more than 30 years, did you or other members of your family lose hope at any time that some of the truth or the evidence that could point to your brother's innocence come out?
No, I never lost hope. I always was concerned that hoping that this would never happen, that I just always knew that something was going to come around, even though this was hard, because it's just hard just talking about it now, just knowing when it broke back up with the beating and stuff, I just knew it had to be justice somewhere to help my brother. So even though things lay low and it picked back up, I always had that hope that that something is going to intervene someday about Gary.
Bobby, how old were you when Gary was arrested, when he was 16?
At that time, I was about 20 years old.
And what were you hearing at that time? What did you understand had happened?
What I had understand that it was, at that time, the kids It was integrated at the school. And it just started off from a football game that it just looked like they just couldn't get a loan or something, you know. And by all of this was going on, and when that happened with Gary, it's like it was just so upsetting to hear that, you know, people couldn't get a loan. And we wasn't raised like that, you know. We always was raised around every different color, you know, to learn to love one another. And it just was a hurting thing to see that this kind of stuff that was going on. And it had went down with Gary.
Bobby McRae and Juanita Tyler and Bob Herbert, we're going to go to break. But when we come back, we're going to play never before excerpt of interview with Gary Tyler that was done several years ago while he, of course, was in prison. Stay with us. Silent is guilty, what judge has said, sir. What right do we understand? Planted, no matching bullets, no prints on the handle, no proof to show. But Tyler is guilty, the white judge said so. To show him no mercy, they won't let him go. Tyler is guilty, white judge said so. What crime do we have to say it's not so? Tyler is guilty, white judge said so. What crime do we have to say it's not so? UB40 here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. I want to turn to one of the few recorded interviews ever done with Gary Tyler since he was in prison 32 years ago. It was about 10 years ago. A student named Maya Weirdmeester spent over 5 hours interviewing Gary Tyler in prison. This interview has never been aired before. In this excerpt, Gary talks about what happened at school on October 7th, 1974.
We got on the bus, and the bus proceeded to pull off, and that's when a barrage of rock, stone, bottles, and everything was hitting against the bus, okay? And kids on the bus panicked. Some started rushing toward the front and everything else. Okay, then that's when we heard a pop sound. And Kojo stopped the bus, and he got off the bus. And that's when the state police officer told him to get back on the bus. So he got back on, and he pulled it on some drive. And that's when they went to shaking out everybody that was leaving off the bus. And Ike Randall, in which case my cousin, police pulled him on the side. And when I got off the bus, I looked and I asked him what was wrong. He told me that they were arresting him because he had a 22 bullet with a chain around his neck. So I went to explain to the officer that I had one too. They arrested him for wasn't anything illegal. So the guy told me to come back across the ditch. So when I went to jump across the ditch, that's when another police officer stopped me.
Gary Tyler goes on to talk about how the police beat him after he was taken to the police station.
Then that's when they came and got me. Mm-hmm. They brought me in. Okay, me and Eric Smith was in the same room. So that's when the officer went to writing a report on Eric Smith and myself. Mm-hmm. And when he asked me how old I was, I told him 16 years old. So he looked at me. He said, "You dumb motherfucker! Why didn't you tell me you was a juvenile?" I said, "You didn't ask me. Stupid motherfucker." Okay, that's when they brought me in the back of the substation and they proceeded to beat on me. Okay, so it lasted about a few hours. Okay, so when they finally decided to let my mother and father see me, you know, and but you can say within that time, that's where they said Nelson Coleman had talked to me. If I tell them who fired the gun, that you know, that would let me off the hook. Understand who did it, and if I did it, tell them that they did it because excuse me, tell them that I did it because only thing that happened to me, I'd go to Scotland, understand, and I'd be out after a few years. I told him for something I didn't do. So when he realized he couldn't get anywhere with me in reference to that, he left, and that's when he sent other officers in there. And they went to threaten me and stuff like that again.
Gary Tyler, never before broadcast interview in prison. He's been in prison for more than 32 years. He's at Angola Prison in Louisiana. His mother and sister, Juanita Tyler and Bobby McRae, with us from New Orleans. They just came back from visiting Gary yesterday. And in studio with us at the firehouse here in New York is Bob Herbert, a New York Times columnist who's done three columns on the case of Gary Tyler. Now, the gun. Bob, talk about this gun.
All right. They start off, they're investigating this thing, but they don't have a weapon. They don't have any evidence at all. Excuse me. So they search all the students on the bus. They search the bus itself. They don't find any weapon. They take Gary Tyler in. The beating occurred, that sort of thing. And then suddenly, miraculously, they come up with a weapon. It's a .45 caliber pistol, and they say that they found it on the bus. Now, the bus driver insists, even after all these years, he says, I watched them when they searched that bus. I saw the seat that they said they found this gun in. There never was any gun on this bus. Well, it turned
out. In the history of the gun?
Well, it turned out that this gun had been stolen from a firing range that was used by the sheriff's deputies in Destrehan. That's the first thing. The second thing is that that gun has since conveniently vanished. It vanished as conveniently as it appeared. So as the appeal process goes forward, if his lawyers are trying to do something, they can't use the gun as evidence to show that they could not connect it to the crime. So that's one thing. Another point that I think is important to make is that a federal appeals court ruled that Gary did not get a fair trial. They said that the charge to the jury was flawed, and they said that it was flawed so badly that it clearly could have had an impact on how the jurors ruled. But they were so insistent on not having this case overturned and not having Gary Tyler freed or have a new trial that they ruled on a technicality, that he did not deserve a new trial. So it's on the record that a federal appeals court has said that his trial was fundamentally unfair.
I'd like to ask you also about the witnesses. Supposedly there were four witnesses against mm-hmm. him, all of whom have since recanted. And in one of your columns, you write about one of those witnesses. A sworn affidavit from Larry Dabney, who was seated by Mr. Tyler on the bus, was typical. He said his treatment by the police was the scariest thing he'd ever experienced. Quote, they didn't even ask me what I saw. They told me flat out that I was going to be their key witness. They told me I was going to testify that I saw Gary with a gun right there after I heard the shot, and that a few minutes later I had seen him hide it in a slit in the seat. That was not true. I didn't see Gary or anybody else in that bus with a gun.
That's right. And he has, all of these witnesses have held to the story, the recantation, all of these years. There's been no wavering on that. And their stories are so consistent that you just tend to believe them. I mean, they all tell the same story about how they were treated and threatened by the sheriff's deputies, terrorized, actually, because they were told that they would be implicated in the murder and would go to prison for several years. And then the other thing is that the main witness against Gary, who had actually been a former girlfriend of his, was a very troubled young woman who was under the care of a psychiatrist and was known to have reported false crimes to the authorities before, including a false report of a kidnapping. I mean, that was known, understood. She became the main witness in the case.
Mm. Now, Juanita and Bobby, presumably you knew some of the people who testified because these were the classmates of your son, Gary. Juanita, what was your response as these witnesses came forward and then recanted?
Well, you know, you'd be surprised when you hear these kind of things, you know, with the kid, you know, with them, And so, you know, like, I just heard about it after it had happened. And like I said, I was not allowed in the courtroom, and I don't know what the high, you know, the witness of what they say, you know, because we was allowed near in the chorus, the courtroom, you know. So, but I was really hurting. But these kids came to us and crying and how they were strutting their pants and everything, was so scared until they just told their kids to do what they had to do.
And the lawyer who represented your son, could you talk about him and the interchange your family had with that defense lawyer?
Oh, Lord. But at the time, see, I'd never been in anything before, or knew anything about a lawyer, anything. And we had hired Jack Williams. We was represented to some friends of us that told us about Jack Williams. We went to him. He took the case. And he would tell us things that he had everything together, you know, and we thought that he did. Oh, Gary's going to get out of that because we know Gary didn't do nothing. But when trial came up, I don't know. When the trial, you know, when they had the trial on Gary, Gary was found guilty and sent to the electric chair.
And Bob, what about the lawyer, attorney? You've written about him as
this
well.
This was a lawyer who had tried a murder case before, much less a death penalty case. He had only minimal contact with Gary, who was already locked up, and he was complaining that he wasn't being paid enough money. I mean, the family was very poor, and he was complaining that he wasn't getting the fees that he deserved. And if you look at the trial record, there just was not much of a defense put forth for Gary Tyler. I mean, this whole thing was pretty much guaranteed to end up in a conviction.
I want to turn to another excerpt of the interview with Gary Tyler. Here he talks about his trial before an all-white jury.
Well, I think my fate was already sealed. I think my fate was already sealed. And no matter what I said on that witness stand, they wouldn't have believed me, either way it goes. Even when I was trying to explain to them how the police brutally beat me, they didn't want to hear that. They didn't want to hear nothing that I had to say in reference to the way I was treated. Nothing. Just imagine the climate at that time. The time I was in there, I was harassed by the police officers. How they terrorized me at night, shooting mace in my cell, shining lights, floodlights in the window at night, getting on a bullhorn. I'm like, Gary Tyler, nigga, we're gonna hang you. That kind of atmosphere that. And then going to court when your mother and your family is shut out the courthouse and you in there just with an attorney that you don't really know whether he's fighting for you or not. That, the atmosphere that I had to deal with. And I thought at that time to try to deal with that issue was a lie. And that's what I did. I lied, said that a gun was being passed. That's what I said, a gun was being passed. Knowing it was not the truth. I did that.
Gary Tyler speaking from prison. Bob Herbert, an all-white jury.
All-white jury. Yeah, I mean, he was absolutely right. I mean, I believe that the system was rigged at that point, that they needed someone, they needed a black person to convict for this killing, and that he was the designated killer.
You also talk about another case. In this case, it was a black young man who was killed.
Yep. There was a fellow named Richard Dunn who had attended a dance that was actually a benefit dance to raise money for Gary Tyler's defense. And so it's about, I think, 1 o'clock in the morning, and people are going home from this dance, and Richard Dunn is walking with another fellow, and a car comes by with some white fellows in it. Somebody leans out of the car with a shotgun and shoots Richard Dunn to death, kills him. So they find the guy who killed him, a fellow named Anthony Mart. They found him. They tried him like they were supposed to. He was convicted, and he was sentenced to life in prison. And what happened? After 10 years, he received a pardon and was allowed to go free. So here's a white guy who killed a black guy, absolute stranger, in cold blood. He does 10 years, and he's freed. In Gary Tyler's case, Gary Tyler would not be in prison if he was white, and he would not be in prison if the person he was accused of killing had been black. This is really an absolutely racially motivated case.
And who granted the pardon?
Well, it's the state of Louisiana grants the pardon. You have to get a recommendation from the pardon board, and if the governor signs the pardon, the person could be free. This could have happened at any number of points in Gary Tyler's case.
So, Juanita Tyler, your son lived with the death penalty for years before it was overturned in Louisiana. How did he hold up? How did you hold up?
We would just communicate, and he would always say, tell me, as long as I can hold up, he can hold up. And that's how we pulled through all these many years, is by me trying to keep myself alive, and so he's still alive. And I'm just proud that we was able to hold out, and I'm glad to be here, to still to be, to see, to go and visit him and talk to him. And I'm still holding on, and he's still holding on.
I'd like to ask you, Bob Herbert obviously has written now in the New York three columns on your son's case. How have the newspapers and television stations in your own state of Louisiana, how have they covered this case?
Well, in the beginning, they did a little something when they was just using the word of what Gary had done. But I haven't really saw anything that the stations here did to help Gary.
Bobby McRae, how has this affected your family? Gary is one of 11 of the kids, your brothers and sisters?
Yes. You was finished?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. It's really it really affected us really bad. You know, we were scared all the time, and he just was harassed so bad. And he was by the people in the neighborhood was really scared. They were scared to talk to us, and but they always say just hang in there. You know, that's how we made it. We knew they had the love for us, but they were scared to hang with us because they was knowing that we was being threatened, and so that they didn't want to have anything to do too close to us, but they would try to do everything they could for us, but they were scared, and that had us more scared because we knew that phone calls, everything just was rushing us, and you know, and we just hung in there before. If it wasn't for Jehovah God through Jesus, that's how our family really made it, through prayers and the love of people that who supported us and just told us to hang in there. That's what made us strong to deal with this problem.
Bobby, you've been doubly hard hit. Your brother's in prison, has been there for 32 years. Your home was destroyed in Hurricane Katrina?
It didn't get destroyed like the people way, because we like about 20 miles from New Orleans, where all of this, the real bad effect. But we had a lot of damage in our roof, and then we had to repair a lot, but we didn't get totally destroyed because we was like in a distance. But the destroyed was just seeing other people got destroyed, and then the things that we went through with Katrina, and we just tried to keep our faith so that we wouldn't be really crushed through by that and all the other things happening in our life.
And I'd like to ask Bob Herbert about where the case is now, given all these recanted witnesses, given the information that's available. Where is it in the courts, if anywhere, right now?
Well, it's not in the courts, but there's a renewed focus on the case. And I think it's really great that you guys are focusing on it on your program. I mean, I think that's going to be a big help. And so Gary Tyler's lawyers have to decide what's the next affirmative step that they're going to take. I spoke to Governor Blanco's office, and they made it clear to me that nothing will be initiated at the state level, but they said that, you know, you could submit, for example, another request for a pardon, and then that would be duly considered. I think with the kind of attention that the case is getting, it puts a little pressure on the governor to rule, you know, perhaps in Gary's favor. You have to see. But the lawyers have not made a decision yet. They're looking also to see if there's another route besides a pardon. I think they need to move pretty quickly because the spotlight is not going to stay on the case too long. And after a while, once again, Gary Tyler will be forgotten about.
Way back then, it was a black officer, right, that Gary had words with on the bus.
Yeah,
that seemed to be the thing that singled.
One of the few black deputies on the staff of the sheriff's department at that time. And he took umbrage at the Gary Tyler making a smart remark to him. And that came up at the trial, actually, because Gary had been charged, before he was charged with this murder, he was charged with disturbing the peace. That was the charge for originally taking him into custody. And when they put this officer on the witness stand, they said, whose peace was he disturbing? And the response was, mine. That's what the officer said. His peace was disturbed.
Well, I want to go back to Gary Tyler for a final time, to that interview, this first time it's being broadcast. He's always maintained his innocence. He says the state continues to hold him because they don't want to acknowledge he was mistakenly arrested and jailed 32 years ago.
My fight is to get out of prison, not to be bitter, not to seek vengeance on anyone, not to hate anyone, but to get out of prison. Hoping that I get out of here a free man, a man man is able to prove his innocence. Then again, I don't think it's so much an issue of me proving my innocence now, okay? I feel that enough has been done to exonerate me of that. It's just that the system is not receptive to that. The system is not receptive to the mistake that they made in my case. Just like they made in other cases around this country. They're not receptive to that. 24 years. I mean, it implies to release me now, it would imply that they knew all along. They don't want to be labeled as the villain. But as long as I continue to be here, it will never die. It will be a thorn in their side. I assume that they expect from the beginning, well, we can just scapegoat them and send them to prison. And we never hear anything else about it. Probably done did it before. Or they probably haven't done it before. It just happened that this case didn't work out the way they expected to.
Gary Tyler, in prison for 32 years, since he was 17 years old. Bobby McRae and Juanita Tyler, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Juanita, any last words to leave with our listeners and viewers in this country and around the world?
I would like to ask the people if anything that they want to do for Gary Tyler, to help with Gary, they can call Gary Tyler, freegarytyler.com. I would love for that to get out to people who ever want to, you know, do some help for Gary.
Again, that website is freegarytyler.com, and we will also link to it at democracynow.org. Again, also, Amnesty International is renewing its call to the Louisiana authorities for a pardon to be granted to Gary Tyler, the 49-year-old African-American man who's been in prison in Louisiana since the age of 17. And whose 1975 trial, they say, was infected with racial prejudice. Juanita Tyler, Bobby McRae, thank you for joining us from New Orleans. And Bob Herbert, New York Times columnist, who has written three columns on this piece. I hope the fourth column will show some progress in this case, albeit after 32 years. We'll stay with you after break. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Fall of 1955. Lord, I had a fall, babe. '55. The police picked me up, handcuffed me, carried me to jail. Locked me down. They tried me for my life. April 6, 1956.
That song is Angola Penitentiary Blues by Robert Pete Williams. He was a former prisoner at Angola. He died in 1980. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org, and our headlines are available there in transcript form, in Spanish as well, and in audio form for any radio station to take. 100 radio stations around the world are taking those headlines in Spanish as well. We're talking to Bob Herbert, New York Times columnist, whose book is called Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream, a collection of his columns. Angola, you did not get to go to Angola to speak with Gary Tyler.
No, I wanted to, but they wouldn't allow me. It was very interesting. The word came back that we're not interested in having our inmates speak to reporters to politicize their plight, that sort of thing. And then we began to look at the possibility of going there just as a visitor, a personal visitor. It was very interesting. They talked to my assistant, and one of the things that you have to put down in your application is what your race is. They want to know what color you are if you're coming to Angola.
I mean, Angola is a famous prison, of course, named for the African country where slaves were brought from. It's a plantation prison, something like 5,000 prisoners.
It's a hideous place. I mean, it's a long, horrible history. Documentaries have been done on it. Books have been written about it, you know, and it's still not a good place. Hmm. Not a good place to be.
Bob, we'd like to, in the time we have left, talk to you a little bit about some of the stuff you've been writing about at the Times. And I'd like to ask you, recently in today's paper, for instance, you write about the amazing revelation that the Reverend Al Sharpton has connections way back among his line of relatives to Strom Thurmond's family that the Daily News revealed on Sunday.
Right.
Talk about that.
Well, kind of amazing. I put in the column just when you thought the news couldn't get any weirder, right? You know, so it turns out that Al Sharpton's great grandfather, I guess, was owned by relatives of Strom Thurmond, that in fact Sharpton knew that his family had Florida connections, but he didn't know until you guys at the Daily News decided to bring this stuff forward, which was a great story, by the way. He didn't realize that his ancestors had been taken from South Carolina to Florida, and the reason was that there was this a woman named, her last name was Thurmond Sharpton, who had actually, her husband had died, she was a widow, and he left debts, so those debts had to be paid off. So relatives of hers in South Carolina sent a family of slaves south so that they could be sent out to work to pay off these debts. And the slaves who were sent south were the family of Al Sharpton's great-grandfather. I think the most interesting thing to me about this stuff, I mean, the biggest news value seems to have been the Thurman Sharpton connection. I mean, I understand that. But to me, the most interesting part is that it's just his great-grandfather who was a slave, which means that, you know, slavery is within striking distance. As far as I'm concerned, if it's your great-grandfather, it means that you can almost reach out and touch it. As Al Sharpton told me, he knew his grandfather, and this was his grandfather's father. I knew my great-grandfather. I mean, many people know their great-grandparents, you know, so slavery is still that close to us. And the other thing that I tried to point out in the story is Sharpton had said, you know, that sort of the dehumanization really comes home to you when it's your relative that's involved, and that's fully understandable. And he said that that had not been that clear to him until this occurred. And I think there's a lot of things about slavery, which is such an uncomfortable topic, that's not that clear to most Americans. One is that it's not in the far, such a far distant past as we tend to think. We'd like to relegate it to the past, but it's not that far back. But the effects of slavery are still very much with us. And I pointed out that in a book that I had recently read that is fantastic called Inhuman Bondage, how the commodities produced by the slaves, things like tobacco, coffee, chocolate, cotton, these are very popular commodities, and people just really wanted them just simply because they existed. And that was the beginning of sort of like this global mass market that we're so familiar with now, that you had these commodities that people wanted it, and because you had this free labor, you could provide it in enormous quantities. And the other thing, of course, is that the horrible legacy of slavery is this racism that is very much still with us. I mean, even though the slaves were freed after emancipation, they were at the bottom of the caste system. They were vilified. We're doing this story about Gary Tyler today. So that racism, which I contend is still widespread, a lot of people like to think that that's gone as well. That racism is one of the worst legacies, obviously, of slavery.
And, of course, Strom Thurmond, it came out after he died, had a black daughter that mm-hmm. he never revealed.
Yeah, I mean, the devastation to families that slavery, racism, that post-slavery period, the devastation to families, the agony, the pain, very often the deaths that resulted. And it's a horrendous story. We really need to know more about it. I mean, people would like to turn away from it, and that's understandable. I think we need to know more about it because that would help us understand how we're affected by it now.
So the question would be, will Al Sharpton go to the Thurman family reunion next year to further the discussion?
Al seems to be a little troubled by this. Generally, he's a little more sure of himself when he's speaking. He's been more thoughtful and more respective on this particular story.
Let's talk about Sean Bell for a minute. The grand jury is still in process right now. Not clear whether the police officers will be indicted or not. Sean Bell is the young African-American man who was gunned down by police in a hail of police bullets just hours before he was to be married. You've written about him.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's ridiculous that this investigation is dragging on as long as it has. I mean, it indicates that, they're, as far as I'm concerned, that they're less interested in justice, and I don't know what justice would be. I mean, you know, let the grand jury go whichever way it goes, but I think they're less interested in justice than in getting the police officers off. I think that this is another story that tells us something about police training, this horrendous overreaction, so we have another tragedy on our hands. I want to know why so much of an effort was put into essentially trying to catch underage drinkers. I mean, we have this huge undercover operation with backup cops out on the street and that sort of thing. And then, it leads us to the recent revelations about how many people are stopped and frisked in this city. And I guess it's since 2002, the number has gone up fivefold. You have more than 500,000 people in 2006, just 1 year, who were stopped and in many of those cases frisked by the police officers. Only a very small percentage of those stops lead to arrests. What's going on here? And it's not little old ladies and middle class whites who are being stopped by the police. It's overwhelmingly blacks and Hispanics. And I just think that this is an outrage. It's humiliating. I mean, you have to, like, put your hands up against the wall. People are patting you down. They put their hands anywhere they want to. And it's something that I think more attention needs to be paid to.
Yeah, you've also written extensively on the war in Iraq and on the dance of the various Democratic candidates to carve out a position that appears to be an opposition but is not quite clear what that opposition is.
It seems to me that the Democratic Party in general does not know what to do about this war. I mean, it's clear looking at the polls that the proper position is to be against this war and to beat up on the Bush administration. Some of us understood that this was a war that needed to be opposed from the very beginning. But even, you know, let the Johnny-come-latelys come lately. At least now, let's have a plan for moving forward. And that's what I really don't see. And I think the Democratic political candidates are essentially trying to determine, I guess it's understandable, but they wanted to determine what's in their best political interest. But when you have people dying in combat and being killed, then I think that that's the point where you need to turn away from politics and look at what's in the best interest of the soldiers and Marines that we're sending into the field, and then, of course, overall, what's in the best interest of the country.
Talk about the race between Hillary Rodham Clinton and Barack Obama.
Well, this is really interesting. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that Barack does not have to win this race, whereas Hillary does have to win it. You know, it's unlikely that she's going to get another crack.
McCain is much older than her.
That's true, but I just get the feeling that this is it for the Clintons. I mean, if it was a different candidate other than Hillary Rodham Clinton who was running for the first time, I wouldn't make that statement. But I think she needs to probably win it this time around. But Barack hurts her in a lot of ways. He's a fresh face. The Clintons are no longer the fresh faces on the block. He's a threat to the black vote, which the Clintons has always been crucial to the Clintons' political chances. So it's a real interesting fight.
In your column, you call the Clintons the connivers.
I thought that I was a little outraged by the way the Clintons have geared up to muddy up Barack Obama.
How have they done that?
Well, in the first place, behind the scenes, I mean, they're really putting the squeeze on people who would like. The first point I think that needs to be made is if you're going to start the presidential election this early, really early, then the one benefit that you could get out of that is that voters will get to see the candidates over an extended period of time. What the Clintons want to do is come in there with a very powerful machine that they have and shut this debate down as quickly as possible. So if Barack or someone affiliated with this campaign makes a comment critical of the Clintons come back gangbusters and assert that this is the politics of personal destruction. Well, that's not true. What we want here is a very public debate. So I think that the steamroller tactics of the Clintons are to be regretted.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Bob Herbert, for being with us. Bob Herbert is a columnist with the New York Times. Again, has written three columns recently on the case of Gary Tyler, and you can get more at the website, freegarytyler.com. We will link to that at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Bergstrup, Abdul Kadus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Matei, Jen Yutz, Anuradha Bhagwati, Megan Whitney, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.